Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Books about the business and business people of baseball are becoming more available these days. I devote a whole chapter on the topic in 501 Baseball Books. I think fans tend to forget that the people who run baseball aren't born to the position. Just like everybody else, they grow into the job based on years of experience. One of the more talked about titles this year, for various reasons, is Steve Kettman's Baseball Maverick, How Sandy Alderson Revolutionized Baseball and Revived the Mets. Kettman starts with Alderson's military career as a major point in explaining the veteran executive's philosophy, expectations, and strategies. Alderson was with the Oakland A's and was Billy Beane's mentor at the dawn of the Moneyball era. Kettman has written his own books, worked as a ghostwriter, notably for Jose Canseco's memoir Juiced, and served as an editor for Game Time, a baseball companion, a compilation of Roger Angel's New Yorker essays. I spoke with Kettman last week about the varying degrees of difficulties in the disparate projects.
Steve Kettman, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Let's start right away with the title of the book, Baseball Maverick, How Sandy Alderson Revolutionized Baseball and Revived the Mets. Let's parse that a little bit. Define maverick, because to me it means someone who bucks tradition, an innovator like Bill Veeck. So how do you see Alderson as a maverick?
Well, I would say a maverick is someone who does things their own way and is very smart. Like the original maverick, Samuel Maverick, was a Texas landholder who had so much land, he really didn't care about the cattle that he had, but he let his cattle roam free with no brands. So what happened was the other ranchers just came to assume that any cattle that did not have brands, unbranded cattle, was what they call a maverick, which means it belonged to Maverick. So in the end, the guy ended up with a lot of extra cattle that wouldn't have been his.
Nice.
That's pretty clever.
Very interesting, yeah. Good analogy of the word. Because prior to this, my reference to Maverick was the television show with James Garner.
So, I love that show, I have to say.
All right, yeah. Second part. How did Alderson revolutionize baseball?
Well, that relates to the Maverick part as well. And something that really interested me, Ron, was I, in the 90s, worked for the San Francisco Chronicle. I was a sports writer. And from 94 to 98, I was the Oakland A's beat writer. So in those years, there wasn't, a lot of wins to write about. But what we did have to write about was the relationship between Billy Beane, who was then assistant general manager, and his mentor, Sandy Alderson. Now, the Haas family had bought the team from Charlie Finley, and they had introduced a lot of what we would call now very progressive practices. And it was in that environment where there was a lot of experimentation, there was a lot of thinking outside the box. And this is when you brought the first computers in baseball were brought in. Apple actually donated those because Apple at the time was an obscure little startup in Silicon Valley. And they wanted some publicity. So a clever A's exec made a deal with them. And those were the first computers in baseball. This was all moving very quickly. And Sandy Alderson started reading Bill James. He started reading Eric Walker, the author of The Sinister First Baseman, who was in California and did a number of studies on statistical analysis for the A's. And so Alderson had brought him in. This was the start of the revolution in baseball that most people think of as Moneyball and think of as Billy Beane later on. And I was around when, Billy Beane, it's no knock on Billy, who I think probably you share my respect and your listeners. I know Billy very well. He cooperated fully for the book. He's a friend and a very smart guy. But in his formative period, he would literally follow Alderson around wearing a matching outfit and, really try to be like Sandy. So the revolution in baseball when it comes to front offices and how they're run now goes back to this period, and that was something I wanted to capture. The title, Maverick, to loop back around to that, I did talk to Billy a lot for this book, and he gave me a quote about how he saw Alderson as a true maverick, in that he thought for himself, and he was gonna run a baseball team the way he wanted to, throwing a lot of old conventional wisdom out the window. So that was my starting point, the Billy Beane quote.
And finally, how can you say he revived the Mets given their record since he's been general manager? I know a lot of it is not his doing, you know, given the limits on the payroll because of the Bernie Madoff situation. But I think Mets fans would say that he has not really revived the Mets, although things always look, with the crop of young players they have, things always look promising, but they always seem to fall a little bit short.
Hey, I understand. Any Met fan who sees that title and subtitle and reacts emotionally and says, "Oh my God, shut up, you know, we've got something going on here. Don't jinx it." I totally understand that. I'm a lifelong baseball fan. I have that emotional side to me. But my job is to be an analyst. I've reported on a lot of different subjects, not just sports. And I spent 4 years working on this book with incredible access to Alderson. He gave more than 100 interviews and talked to a lot of the players, really put a lot of work into trying to tell this story. And it was my analysis at deadline time, you know, late last year, that this team has been revived. If you look it up in the dictionary, it doesn't mean you won a World Series. It means that you were asleep, you were knocked out, and you've been revived. You've woken up, you're off the mat, you're ready to compete, you're ready to be exciting. You know, I'm in New York right now, and the buzz here is much more Mets than it is Yankees. And, you know, things could go south for the Mets. That's always possible. But where they are going into the season is that there is more excitement. There's more of a sense around baseball. If you talk to other teams about the Mets really being a team to watch, I mean, Tom Verducci, who, you know, was part of the play-by-play team for the World Series, wrote in Sports Illustrated that the Mets, the Cubs, and the Red Sox are his three choices as, you know, surprise playoff teams. So I think that Alderson and his team there, DePodesta, J.P. Ricciardi, John Rico, and others, that they really set about trying to call it rebrand or try to shift the culture in a way where they're not focused on trying to, you know, bounce in there and make a mark in one playoff. They're trying to base their success on depth in the farm system and developing that depth year after year after year so that they can really be a force every year. And that's what I see as being behind the revived title.
And the farm system has been improving to the point where I believe it was voted the best one of the past year.
That's right. Yeah, Baseball America put their number of top prospects tied for first in all of baseball. And it has consistently improved every year. The Mets' win-loss record remains very problematical for six seasons now. But in the farm system last season, the Mets' farm system had the best win-loss record in baseball. So there are a lot of indications of better things coming.
Now, in the book, you start with Alderson's military background, and you refer to it often. You know, why did you choose to use that as your launch point?
Well, because I know Sandy Alderson. You know, the more you know him, the more you understand how important the Marine Corps was in shaping his way of looking at really any problem and any solution, but especially how you try to organize people. There isn't really a lot of leadership in baseball. I think that, you know, this isn't the time to talk about Bud Selig and his tenure, but leadership was never his style. Getting behind-the-scenes consensus was his style. Well, Sandy Alderson is a guy who was chosen by the United States Marine Corps as one of the top military figures of his generation. When he served at Marine Barracks, Washington, he served with guys like Pete Pace and James L. Jones. They were all on the same path. And, of course, those two went on to be, you know, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Barack Obama's national security advisor. And it was there that Alderson really studied leadership, and leadership in the sense of setting an example, yes, but getting everybody involved. So one thing that's come out of the Moneyball craze, I guess we could say, is the idea that, you know, Billy Beane is so smart that he doesn't have to listen to anybody. Well, Billy's a friend of mine, and that's not true. I mean, Billy was very proud of, you know, Farhan for a while as his assistant GM and moved on to the Dodgers. But Billy's had a lot of good people around him as well, and he does listen to other people, and he does believe in building a culture where you have people speaking up. But in New York, that is something that Alderson has really done, where he's got a lot of people that all feel empowered to speak their mind. And I believe that's something that he would say very much comes to him from his approach that he learned in the Marine Corps.
Now, it seems like coming from a military background where you're used to having people listen to you rather than sharing their points of view and giving their opinions. I'm just wondering about the juxtaposition. You know, Sandy's in his mid-60s at this point, and what his relationship is like with this young generation of players.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, the idea that if you're in your 60s, you know, there's going to be a little distance between you and the players. Alderson's belief is that when it comes to players and actually everybody in his professional life, he wants to be friendly but professional. So he wants to engage them, but to keep some distance. He doesn't want to try to be buddies with them. And I do think that, you know, I talked to various players during my 4 years of work on the book, you know, Travis d'Arnaud, Zach Wheeler, you know, Lucas Duda, and they respect Alderson more than they feel like they really knew him, you know, and in some ways that's probably a function of his age. But then again, you know, Billy Beane's getting older now too, so I don't know the answer to that one. I think that, I know as a sports writer, I remember I covered the A's, I was in my, you know, 30s, and I saw guys doing that job who were in their 50s, and I thought I would never want to do that because of the distance that the age introduces.
Well, certainly you speak about the professionalism and the distance. I mean, the general manager has to make the decisions whether to trade a player to another team or send him down to the minors, and you refer to that frequently in the book. I'm thinking particularly of the Ike Davis situation where, you know, every day could have been his last, and how difficult it is, thinking about the movie Moneyball, where the scenes where he tells his assistant that you have to learn how to tell someone he's been sent down or traded.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really tough thing. You know, and I did talk about it with Ike Davis, and he felt it was all handled professionally. He did kind of make a point to me that compared to Omar Minaya, that Sandy Alderson was a much different sort of figure, and that there was a more, he used the term businesslike, which I myself wouldn't characterize it that way. But I do know that, you know, Alderson, for example, he's a guy who shows up. Like he very often goes over to the hospital in New York when a guy has a, you know, an MRI or, you know, after a surgery to just visit them. It doesn't show up in a newspaper article or a tweet. It's something he does on his own. But, you know, that was one thing when I worked on this book. I spoke to Dennis Eckersley at one point, the Hall of Fame closer. Great guy, by the way. It was fun covering him. But, you know, I'm actually drawing a little bit of a blank on the story he told me, but it was one of these stories of, like, Sandy, you know, that about Alderson showing up at something, and I can't remember what it was. Was it was a funeral or a wedding or, you know, something like that. But over the years, Alderson has done a lot of that kind of thing, where the stuff that really matters to people, he's there. He might not be the guy to, you know, banter with a player about, you know, a TV show people are talking about or something like that. But I don't think it's fair at all to characterize his approach as cold or aloof. I think it is human. It's just that he doesn't go to that extra place of being kind of a schmoozer. That's not his style.
Now, you said that you've been working on the book for a long time. Did you ever worry or wonder during that course, as the Mets continued to founder, what this would mean to the project, your project?
Absolutely, Ron. Of course I worried. We were going to publish the book, you know, originally 1 year sooner. And then when Matt Harvey's elbow, you know, went and he had to have Tommy John's surgery, we pushed the publication date a year forward. And, you know, it got to be a little bit worrisome of, you know, what if we can't keep pushing it forward, you know. And I had a little bit of a period late last season, but before the end of the year, where I wasn't feeling real great about it. And I couldn't write the end of the book, which I think you just were reading, but I couldn't write that till they'd finished the season. And then, okay, it wasn't a lot, but they did kind of finish the season on a little bit of an uptick. You had just the mere fact of Lucas Duda hitting his 30th home run and obviously enjoying himself out there when he's so, you know, closed and shy. And this is a guy who will, you know, talk to 10 reporters and assure all 10 reporters that he, Lucas Duda, is the most boring guy they'll ever find, that there's nothing interesting about him. That's really who he is. And just to see him, you know, beaming and kind of relaxing out there for the first time, that gave me enough of a look where I felt like, you know, most of what I had been projecting was probably on target.
I want to switch gears a bit now and talk about the process. You've written your own books. You've written books with other people. Is ghostwriter the proper word to use in conjunction with the Jose Canseco's book?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've done a number of books as a collaborative writer, everything from, you know, I did a book called What a Party with Terry McAuliffe, who's now the governor of Virginia and a friend. And, you know, like that one, I was a co-writer, meaning my name was on the cover. And I've done a number of books like that. But for Canseco, I was a ghost. And, in fact, I wouldn't even discuss that role if Jose hadn't talked to a reporter from the New Yorker magazine who asked him, did Steve Kettman write your book? And Jose said, yeah. So I can talk about it. It's cool.
And you've also served as editor for a compilation of Roger Angel essays. Now,
yeah.
How does one edit someone like Roger Angel?
Lightly. No. that project was, I was the editor of the collection. I conceived the book. I was living in Berlin, Germany in those years. And I had written an appreciation of Roger for, it's a website called salon.com that was kind of in the early years of the internet, was pretty big. And it was one of these, like the kind of appreciation the New York Times might write about someone after they, you know, when they die, about a major figure, you know, Louis Armstrong or someone. But the idea was you do it when they're still around. And, you know, I had interviewed Roger. I'd known him for years, a little bit here and there. And, you know, people loved that piece. And Roger himself got a lot of, you know, letters and notes saying someone's finally done you justice. And after that, I called Roger from Berlin and suggested we work together on a book. And my idea was a little bit different at the beginning. I wanted it to be kind of a large, like a Roger Angel reader. And we got a book deal on it immediately, but they wanted it to be more the same size as his other books. So in the end, it was a kind of greatest hits collection where we pulled things that had been previously published. We pulled from the New Yorker archive to find things that hadn't previously been published in book form. So I spent a summer there working at the New Yorker with Roger, and I would go into the archives and dig around, and we would talk about different things. So my role as editor was, you know, to conceive the collection, the organization, which pieces to include, like, you know, the Bob Gibson piece, Distance. I said from the beginning, we have to include this. And it wasn't like Roger argued with me. I think it's understood that that's one of his greatest pieces. But I wasn't telling Roger where to put commas. You can rest assured.
Did you find working with him at all intimidating, given his stature?
Terrifying. You know, the one thing was, if you've read Roger over the years, you know, he always has had a, you know, respect for the working stiffs in the press box. And the fact that I had put in my 4-plus years as an A's beat writer, you know, that gave me something that I brought to the table. I remember a story, you know, I'm sure you know that Roger was for years, a fiction editor of the New Yorker. He edited John Updike. He edited the great Vladimir Nabokov. You know, one of my favorite writers. And I knew Jason Giambi well from Oakland. I covered Jason when he was a young kid. And Jason's a great guy. And so one thing that Roger and I did that summer was we went up to Yankee Stadium so I could introduce Roger to Jason, because it just seemed like something that had to happen. So we're standing there in the Yankee clubhouse waiting to talk to Jason Giambi. And it really is, you know, you may not be ducking jock straps, but almost as much. I mean, you know, sweaty towels come flying across the room and you kind of move. And Roger and I are standing there, and Roger's discussing what it was like editing Nabokov and going on this whole riff about Nabokov. So at times it was intimidating, but Roger could not have been kinder to me and was an absolute pleasure to work with. The first day I arrived, I flew in from Berlin, and the first thing I did was Roger said, come on out to Central Park, we have a softball game. So it was the softball league that included the New Yorker and included the Paris Review. So I go up there, I find him, and I'm sitting on one of those metal benches in the stands watching the New Yorker softball team play the Paris Review. George Plimpton comes bouncing over after pitching the first inning with beers for me and Roger. So the whole thing was just an out-of-body experience. It was just phenomenal.
Sounds wonderful. In today's paper, you have a piece in the opinion section in which you say, don't let statistics ruin baseball. How did that come about?
Well, I do want to take a step back. I have the greatest respect for all the editors at the New York Times. I will just say that, you know, I didn't write the headline. And
which is frequently the case. A lot of people think that the writer and author is responsible for every aspect of the book, but in many cases it's the publisher or editor who decides, you know, we're going to change your headline to this to make it a little more provocative or whatever, and the same thing for titles of books. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so my point is just in the article I say that statistics enhance baseball. I say that, you know, the energy in front offices now with a lot of statistically minded general managers, a lot of very smart people, is a great thing for the game, and it's wonderful. What I talk about or what I focus on is simply, do we watch the games? Nate Silver, you know, made his name with statistical analysis, went from, you know, sports to politics, back to sports. But just before you and I are talking now, I was dealing with them because they kind of, you know, viewed that piece as a real provocation. But one of the people in that discussion came right out and said, you know, he doesn't watch the games. He finds them tedious because he's not going to learn anything from watching the game. I think that is a viewpoint that I part ways with. And I see in the press boxes more and more writers who, A, don't have the space in their newspapers to really tell a story about a game, and who think that what they need to do is spend a lot of paragraphs parsing numbers and don't really tell the human side. And, you know, I grew up on newspapers, grew up reading Roger Angel. I love the human stories. So I was the real gist of that article was to encourage people, study your stats, have great conversations about what they mean, spend hours on that. But when the game starts, let's watch, because there's always something to see if you watch closely.
I know you're, having just finished this book, you're in the middle of a press tour with a number of appearances and whatnot, but are you working on your next project yet?
I am. Grove Atlantic is my publisher for Baseball Maverick, and I am going to spend the next few years doing a major book on U.S. soccer for them. I lived 10 years in Berlin. I was a columnist for the Berliner Zeitung, which is the East Berlin paper. My wife's German. I speak German fluently. I speak German every day. So in getting to know Jürgen Klinsmann, the coach of the U.S. team, I have kind of an edge in understanding his language. And I'm really excited about that project. I grew up playing soccer, and, you know, I love World Cup. I think it's a great, great event. And the U.S. team's been struggling a little bit ever since I got my book deal, you know. But that's going to be something that I follow over the next years, and, you know, I think it's a great project.
And we've been talking with Steve Kevin, author of Baseball Maverick, How Sandy Alderson Revolutionized Baseball and Revived the Mets, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Steve and Sandy will be at the Yogi Berra Museum in Little Falls, New Jersey on Saturday, April 18th at 2 o'clock. Admission is $30, and that includes a copy of the book. For more information or to RSVP, call 973-655-2378. And Steve, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was Steve Kettman, author of Baseball Maverick, the new Sandy Alderson biography. Well, that about wraps up another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. Tune in to the next time when we'll have another guest in the world of baseball pop culture. It'll be a surprise. I don't even know who it is yet. But in the meantime, visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on baseball literature and all that goes with it. Thanks, everybody. See you next time. So grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.